Auto manufacturers are making an arguably half-hearted attempt to meet consumer demands for more energy-efficient vehicles by producing hybrid cars and even hybrid SUVs. But in the 1990s, during a terrible pollution crisis in California, General Motors launched a zero-emissions electric car, the EV1. It was fast, it was quiet, and those who drove it say they loved it. But the EV1 and others that followed it quickly disappeared. A new documentary released Friday in the Bay Area looks at the conception, brief life, and death of the EV1. The film is Who Killed the Electric Car? The film's director, Chris Payne, joins us in our studio. Hi, Chris.
Hey. Hello to you.
And thanks for being with us today. Also here in our studio is Roland Huang. He's an expert on clean vehicle technology and policy. He's been working on these issues for more than a decade, right?
That's right.
He's currently the Vehicle Policy Director at National Resources Defense Council in San Francisco. Welcome, Roland Huang.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Thanks for being here. Chris Payne, how did you come to make the film, Who Killed the Electric Car?
Well, I was feeling guilty about living in Los Angeles, and we had a huge, we had really terrible, terrible problems in 1990 with air pollution. I think one in four kids had respiratory illness from breathing bad air, and California passed a law, and they told car makers that if they wanted to continue selling cars in California, some of those cars would have to be zero-emission vehicles, and the only technology available at that time were electric cars. And in 1996, 1997, they began to put these cars in the market. Everybody, General Motors, Ford, Chrysler, Toyota, Honda. And what shocked them, I think, were they were the most advanced cars they'd ever built. They didn't use any gasoline. They didn't have internal combustion engines, which meant no tune-ups, no repairs. Very, very clean, efficient vehicles. And they began to fight them. And it took them 13 years to overturn the laws. And when I heard about these cars, I got one, and I didn't think I'd like it as much as I did. And very soon I became a convert that this is really the future of cars. So when my car was taken away and the media didn't seem to report the story, I decided to make a film.
And what did you like about your car, the EV1?
Well, I'm a guy. I really liked how fast it was, to be honest. And I love the fact that I never went to the gas station. You just plug in at home, and it didn't cost very much to charge, like I think the equivalent of 75 cents a gallon in terms of electricity. And electricity, of course, for all of its problems, is a lot cleaner on a what they call a well-to-wheel basis than burning gasoline in your car. In fact, even on a national grid, it's half the pollution, at least CO2, as using a gas car. So the pollution element was terrific, and I really became a car lover, much to my shock.
Roland Huang, you've driven an EV1 too.
Yes, I have.
I know this to be true. What did you enjoy it? What did you think about it?
Well, it's a blast. I was not fortunate enough to actually have owned one, but I got a chance a couple of times to drive one, and it's basically like a slot car. I don't know if some of the guys out there who grew up playing with slot cars, but the acceleration on an electric vehicle is fantastic because it's an instantaneous response on the accelerator, whether you're at a standstill or whether you're going 60 miles per hour down the freeway. When you stomp on that accelerator, it just goes. And so great vehicle, great technology, and the great thing about it, I think a lot of people loved back then, and they would love now if the auto companies had kept up with the technologies that you don't have to go to the gas station and fork over your money to the oil companies.
Part of the reason General Motors developed the EV1 was in response to a mandate in the 1990s by the California Air Resources Board, or CARB, known as the Zero Emissions Mandate. Now, Roland Huang, you used to work with CARB as an air pollution engineer.
Correct.
Is that correct? Was that during this period?
I was working on a different issue, but I was actually at the Air Resources Board when, in 1990, they adopted the program. And at that time, the auto companies actually didn't fight the zero-emission vehicle, battery electric vehicle requirement. They were fighting some of the other requirements as part of that program. It wasn't until 1994 when the auto companies, with the help of the oil companies, started to gear up a rather large tens of millions of dollar public campaign to help kill the electric car. And in 1996 was the a very critical Air Resources Board decision, actually. And this is when Pete Wilson was governor. So all the things that Chris's movie talks about was set in motion in 1996 when the Air Board voted under Pete Wilson, who at that time was thinking about running for the Republican nomination for presidency, was probably influenced heavily by the auto companies to strike down the requirement for the battery electric vehicle production that would have started in 1998 and pushed it back to 2003. So by the time the first electric cars got onto the market in 95, 96, 97, the auto companies, I believe, had already made a decision they cannot have the electric vehicle to be a success.
Yeah, it was crazy. I mean, how they changed that mandate. And by the way, two Republican women fought the car companies for years.
Right.
So it was not just a partisan issue. I mean, air pollution impacts everybody. And finally, in 96, unfortunately, California said, okay, you know what, car companies? I guess maybe there's some concern that consumers won't want these cars. So let's put a provision in. And the provision is you only have to make enough cars in accordance with consumer demand. And once they got that compromise, they went full-fledged at trying to dissuade people that electric cars were a solution.
There were some advertisements for the electric cars featured in your film, Chris Payne, your film, Who Killed the Electric Car? It's hard to describe them, I think, without visuals, but can you attempt to do so?
Well, we saw these ads. You know, they won awards, and this is why they were so tricky about it. The photography is beautiful, but they look like tableaus for nuclear war. There's even an explosion that goes off in one of them, and with the shadows of people burned into the sidewalks, and you just go, is this a car commercial or something from Fail Safe or Dr. Strangelove?
I was not living in California at the time that these ads were running, and I saw the film on Friday, and I saw the ads, and I was shocked, absolutely shocked. My jaw fell to the floor. Couldn't believe it. So there were lists of people waiting to get these cars, the EV1, and, you know, you feature some of these folks in your film who had been on lists and didn't get a car, who were on lists and were able to get a car. Who was able to get the cars? It seems like you featured celebrities in your film. Was that a choice because that was just who you wanted to talk with, or was it because they were able to get the cars?
Well, you know, I live in Hollywood, so we only care about celebrities. But the truth is that, you know, the GM salespeople were having such a hard time getting cars to people that they'd have to write a resume to prove to the car company that this person warranted an electric car, especially towards the end. And so they thought, well, to get publicity for this, let's try to get them in the hands of celebrities. So they got one to Tom Hanks and Mel Gibson. And, you know, we interviewed these people because they were dying to talk about their cars. Because they felt like they never really had a voice for these things. So that was good for the film in terms of giving us some really entertaining moments.
Yeah. Amazing. It was funny in the film when Mel Gibson was saying, I had to write a resume to get my car. Just amazing. And you were talking about how the EV1 was not difficult to maintain.
Yeah. I mean, I've had an electric car now. Thanks, Toyota did sell about several hundred of their cars under some pressure, and that's another story. But I've been driving an electric car now for almost 9 years with almost no maintenance at all. I mean, the only thing, what happens in an electric car on a cost basis is that you replace the cost of the internal combustion engine with the cost of a battery pack. And the batteries are, I think Toyota is now warranting their batteries for 100,000, 150,000 miles. And that's pretty much all that goes wrong. And I think this is really why the auto industry went after these cars, because it broke their after parts market and their tune-up market so much.
And then, of course, there must be some sort of influence by big oil. And I think we should talk a little bit more about that. Roland Wong, do you want to chime in here?
Yeah, certainly. It's big oil has heavy influence on politics here in California. And back in 94, actually, is when the big oil conspired with the auto companies to develop a rather large, expensive public campaign to discredit the electric vehicle technology. I think one of the ironic things about it was one of their key points was that the electric vehicle would never work. Well, then the question becomes, why are you spending tens of millions of dollars to kill the technology? And what they did was they hired a public relations firm, in this case Woodward McDowell, who once again is at work to try to help kill off a new initiative that I'd like to talk about in a second. But They ran something which we call an AstroTurf campaign, which is a fake grassroots campaign. They got concerned citizens, they got taxpayer groups, but this is all bankrolled by, guess who? The oil companies, who were not very interested at all in investing in alternatives to petroleum. They like petroleum. They're making lots of money off of petroleum right now. ExxonMobil made $35 billion in profits last year. Chevron, the biggest oil company in California, made $4 billion in profits in the first 3 months of this year. And are they investing any of that money? Well, a very, very small fraction of that money, very, very small, though they advertise it quite heavily, is going into alternatives. Most of that money is being plowed back into producing oil in countries which are sometimes unstable and hostile to the United States. And they're also talking about developing very polluting sources of oil. Tar sands in Canada. We're talking about liquid fuels converted from coal. We're talking about oil shale in Wyoming. These will have an immense impact. And unless we influence their decisions now, they're making so much money now, and they know how to extract the oil from these more polluting sources. Unless we influence their decision now, we need to figure out, it's going to be too late, essentially, to avoid destruction of lands and global warming, of course, is going to be accelerated.
What's the name of the astroturfing group that Western States Petroleum Association has now to beat the initiative you're working on?
The name escapes my mind right now, but it's something similar to back in 94, they developed something called California Against Hidden Taxes. So they have another AstroTurf group and campaign, which has got the same message, which is, well, forcing oil companies to invest in clean alternative fuels actually is a hidden tax. Well, that's just not the case, of course. They're making Chevron made $4 billion in profits in the first 3 months, and they're not investing that in clean alternative fuels. A new initiative, which will be on the November ballot, qualified November ballot, called the Clean Alternative Fuels Act, would raise $4 billion on a severance tax on California-only oil production. This can't be passed on to the consumer. It's not a tax. It would raise $4 billion, and the majority of that money would be used to directly develop competition to oil and petroleum. It would be used to incentivize the installing pumps, to building alternative fuel vehicles, to purchasing alternative fuel vehicles, essentially creating competition and helping rein in these runaway oil prices.
What are some of the types of alternative fuel vehicles, Roland Wong, you'd like to see coming out on the market? What would be better than what we have now? pretty much anything.
Not everything. Unfortunately, not everything, because there are some alternatives out there which actually are more polluting, which the oil companies would like to develop, like liquid, a certain kind of liquid fuel called Fischer-Tropsch that would be made from coal. Just awful, just terrible stuff. But the alternatives that we're looking at incentivizing would be, one, plug-in electric vehicles. Well, electric vehicle is not quite dead, despite the best efforts of the oil companies and the auto companies. It's risen phoenix-like from the ashes. I think the movie Who Killed the Electric Vehicle did a great job of showing you can't suppress great technology. And so there's plug-in, so-called plug-in hybrids, where you basically can take a Prius, you can put more battery packs in there, and you can use it to recharge off the grid. That kind of technology would be incentivized. Another technology which would be incentivized would be cellulosic ethanol. Right now, we use about 6% ethanol blended into our gasoline supply. That's mainly made from corn, imported from the Midwest. That's okay, but not great. And what we need to do is figure out a way to make ethanol from a different source.
Is that like prairie grass?
That's exactly right, like switchgrass or prairie grass. Mm-hmm. Here in California, we could make it from rice straw. Rice straw, which is, used to be open field burn, create a lot of pollution. You could actually convert that into ethanol. So there's a potential here, or the large potential, to produce ethanol from the right kind of sources, the so-called cellulosic sources, waste material, ag waste materials from switchgrass, will reduce global warming pollution by 80% or more. And if you use it in the right way, which is high blends, 85% ethanol rather than the 6% the way we're using it right now, you can help reduce air pollution too, reduce smog.
Isn't there also, you know, for this is where our movie ends too, because we didn't want to have we want to make our movie really entertaining. I mean, so we have a murder mystery, like how did the man take this car down and why, and how are we all involved in it, and how do we keep it from happening the next time? Because they use the same patterns, the same people are after these alternatives now. So, but we do exactly like you said. We ended up on like a hope because this technology is not dead; it's still coming back. And to your point. This ideal car, if you can only have one car, which is, you know, God knows we have enough cars on the road now. It'd be great if we all walked and took bikes and had public transit. But for people who need cars, a single car solution is this plug-in hybrid. And they often call it now the flexible fuel plug-in hybrid. So you're either using the cellulosic ethanol, or I hear that renewable biodiesel that's made from things like chicken parts and from slaughterhouses. I mean, it all sounds really awful, but in terms of a carbon basis, it's a good option. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah. There are a lot of people. I believe the city of Berkeley is using the so-called biodiesel, and you can make it from a variety of sources, including waste chicken parts. But you also can use it from waste vegetable oil from deep fat fryers from your fast food restaurants. Uh-huh. And there's companies that are starting to work on that. But also it can be made from soybeans. It's the other primary source. And I think the only downside is what I understand is that the exhaust smells like French fries.
Which, that's just terrible. What a terrible thing. You know, some people might argue that with the electric car, and this is something that is addressed in your film, Chris Payne, is, you know, it's the energy for the car comes from electricity, and most electricity comes from coal-fired power plants. Is what's the kind of pro-con of that, and how does it balance out?
Yeah, well, that's an excellent question, and I think that it's good that people are getting smarter about thinking about what are the impacts. The oil industry really exploited this when they went after the electric car in the 90s to say, hey, you know, you're just moving the pollution out to Colorado or wherever your coal plant is. And the facts are simply that it's half of the, even on a national mix of electricity, which is 55% coal, you're dropping your CO2, according to the Department of Energy, the Argonne Labs, 45% on CO2. You're also dropping your nitrogen pollution to almost to zero. The one place where you do go up is sulfur, because acid rain is created by coal burning that you don't have with gasoline. Of course, those studies never include the cost of oil spills, the cost of war, all the other hidden costs of oil. And the terrific news is that unlike a car, which slowly gets dirtier the longer you own it, you know, by these SUVs, by the time they're in the inner city, they'll be burning so much dirtier than they are when they're new. An electric grid will keep getting cleaner. We can clean up the coals. The EPA can go after these coal plants, which they dropped all their lawsuits when Bush was elected, sadly. And when you add renewables like wind and solar, all this electricity can be completely clean.
And I'd like to open the lines now so that we can hear from our listeners this hour. The number to call, I keep misplacing it, and it's quite embarrassing, 1-800-958-9008. I'm looking at my producer hoping that is correct. 1-800-958-9008. And you can also email me at sundaysalon@kpfa.org. sundaysalon@kpfa.org. Our guests this hour are filmmaker Chris Payne, whose documentary Who Killed the Electric Car opened this week in the Bay Area, and Roland Huang, Vehicles Policy Director for National Resources Defense Council. We'll be back after this short break. Welcome back to Sunday Salon on KPFA Radio 94.1 FM or www.kpfa.org. I'm your host, Sandra Lupien, sitting in for Larry Bensky. This hour, we are talking about alternative fuel vehicles. We are joined by filmmaker Chris Payne, whose film Who Killed the Electric Car opened this week around the Bay Area. In fact, right now I'm going to tell you some theaters where it's playing. It's at the Clay Theater in San Francisco, at CineArts Empire in San Francisco, the Aquarius Twin in Palo Alto, CineArts in Pleasant Hill, at the Sequoia Twin in Mill Valley, the Rialto in Santa Rosa, and in Berkeley at the Landmark Shattuck Cinema. So it's playing kind of a lot of places right now, and hopefully it will continue to play. Also joining us is Roland Wong of the Natural Resources Defense Council. He is an expert on vehicle policy, clean vehicles. And something we haven't yet talked about this hour before we start taking our listener calls is hydrogen fuel cell technology, which is being pushed by President Bush as the solution to Americans' addiction to oil. Roland Wong, what do you think about that?
Well, I think hydrogen, when people first got excited about it about 10 years ago, and hydrogen and fuel cells, I think that there was a lot of legitimate excitement among scientists and advocates and, you know, people in industry as potentially an electric vehicle that would overcome some of the range problems. I think, like a lot of good technology, this technology in some ways has been hijacked by interests, say, from President Bush, who is trying to look like he cares about this issue of oil dependency, and so has selected a technology which is longer term than some of these nearer term technologies like plug-in hybrids as a way to kind of change the subject, as a way to kind of delay near-term action. Hydrogen has a lot of challenges, and it's looking a lot more difficult than people were claiming 10 years ago. I think we will know in about 2 or 3 years whether hydrogen really is, and hydrogen and fuel cells is really a commercial prospect. The auto companies are claiming in 10 years' time they'll produce these for sale to you and me. But we'll know in about 2 or 3 years' time. Some people believe that we already know. We haven't given up hope on it right now, but the key is that we need to find ways to invest in that technology, in plug-in technology, in cellulosic ethanol technologies, in natural gas, other technologies which will help avoid investments in high-carbon, high-polluting fossil fuel sources.
Chris Payne, do you have some thoughts on the hydrogen fuel cell technology as well?
Yeah, from our reporting of the story, hydrogen fuel cell is a complete bait and switch joke, a giant waste of money, and we're chasing it down. The Chinese and the Japanese are laughing all the way to the bank on this because they're putting their money into batteries and plug-ins and looking at flexible fuel vehicles. And your point actually is very good. There was a lot of hope for it. You know, Amory Lovins, one of the great thinkers of our time, was pushing this out. It turns out the hydrogen fuel cell works quite well in stationary applications, but when you're talking about fuel, the only advantage hydrogen has is that you can use it at a service station. And this, of course, is why the oil companies love this thing, because now you have another fuel they can sell you. The utilities don't get involved. The do-it-yourselfers have to stay out of the way. They get to have their trucks and their refineries. And the problem with it is, of course, they're very, very expensive, and they haven't perfected this, and they may never, is that it takes 3 or 4 times more energy to make hydrogen, because hydrogen's not an energy, it's all by itself, it has to be purified from, you know, from water or wherever the hydrogen is to begin with, than it would if you just took this same electricity and put it into a battery, or if you took the same natural gas and put it right into a tank. So I'm hoping, if nothing else, and you know, in the murder mystery of our movie, Who Killed the Electric Car, this was like the big surprise, like the secret weapon that they all used to convince California to kill the electric car and get ready for this future technology that may never come.
Someone just emailed the Sunday Salon at KPFA mailbox, someone named Ducky in San Jose. They said, what do you think of the cars that run on compressed air? And sent a link to www.theaircar.com. Roland Wong, know anything about them?
Yeah, I believe the technology that he's talking about, or he or she is talking about, is a compressed air storage, which would then be used to run basically an electric vehicle. Instead of having a battery, it has compressed air. This technology, I believe, is in some limited production in France. and I think there's some interest in the United States. I think the primary challenge of that is the range, and that's always been the problem with the electric vehicle. It's besides range, it's a great technology. We'd like to see whether it's compressed air, whether it's lithium-ion batteries, or whether it's cellulosic ethanol. We'd like to see a lot of these technologies come out and flourish and create a market for that. Again, that's what the initiative is intended to do.
And another online listener wants to know about industrial hemp as a potential source of biofuel or cleaner electricity.
I don't know in particular about hemp, but any source of cellulose, plant material, it can, in theory, be broken down using these enzymes. Primarily what scientists are working on are enzymatic processes. The same enzymes that are in the guts of termites, which can break down, which are such pests in your house, it can break down cellulose, convert that into starch, into sugars, any materials. And so what's great about it, whether it's hemp or switchgrass or tree prunings or rice straw, you can convert a lot of stuff that otherwise would go into waste into a clean alternative fuel. And again, the technology is just not going to be there unless there is some sort of government program to help allow this technology to develop and be able to compete with one of the largest, if not the largest, global industry, the oil industry.
That's what one of our characters in our murder mystery who killed the electric car says, you make more money the less alternatives there are. It's in the oil industry's best interest not to have alternatives on the market. That's why that initiative that you guys are supporting is so important.
And I'd like to take a call from one of our listeners who's been holding patiently on the line. Carmen in San Francisco, welcome to Sunday Salon.
Yes, hello, and thank you for having me. I just like to, and I saw the film last night in Mill Valley. It was great. I really enjoyed it. And also, I remember in 1996 in Southern California, I did see an EV1 on the road and said to myself at that time that I want one of those cars. But the marketing of it was that it was a prototype and very difficult to get. And so I did wait till 2000 and bought the Honda Insight. And I bought that 10 days after it was introduced. And I still have it. I have 160,000 miles on it, and it looks pretty much like the day I bought it. Really air-free. And I get about 72 miles a gallon on the highway. And I think they're using the same technique as they did with the electric car, as they're discontinuing that. And you're seeing less and less of them on the road. So they were an alternative that worked. And by the way, tight as well.
Yeah, it's amazing. Ford themselves, just last week, reneged on their commitment to build a certain number, 250,000 Ford Escape hybrids. It's like, why can't these car companies get the message? It's ridiculous. I think the Honda Insight was discontinued, and of course, meanwhile, Toyota is in the driver's seat on hybrids with these Prius cars, and I guess they have a couple other ones, right?
Yeah, Honda is discontinuing the Insight, which is a two-seater. It's a very small vehicle. It's kind of a limited market is what they feel. But they are building the Civic Hybrid. Is now the new Civic model is in a hybrid version, and it's a great vehicle. And they also are building an Accord, and they'll come out with some more hybrid models. Toyota is definitely in the leadership position. They're in the pole position. Mm-hmm. They've got so many different models. The Camry is the most recent hybrid model they have out there. It is very unfortunate. You see the problems domestic manufacturers are having. Ford, General Motors, Daimler Chrysler, they're owned by the Germans now. But these companies have made their money over the past decade on selling SUVs and pickup trucks, polluting, gas-guzzling vehicles. And now in the era of $3.20 gasoline here in California, they are suffering. General Motors sales off 26% last month from a previous year's same month.
Can you believe they're offering you a cash bonus to help you pay for gasoline if you bought one of these big trucks? That's just crazy. Their management, what are they thinking?
They don't seem to be getting it. And it's unfortunate. The same situation which happened during the oil crisis during the 70s is repeating itself now. The domestic auto companies don't seem to be getting it. The future is in clean alternative fuel, fuel-efficient vehicles. It's not in gas.
They don't have to be sacrifices. I truly, this EV1 was the best car I ever drove. I mean, sure, it was a two-seater, but of course Toyota had a four-seater. And once you get in one, you feel like you're in Autotopia when you're like 9 years old. You step in and you go, whoo, it's like all AC powered, extremely powerful. And I think the car companies are just too used to that internal combustion engine and their business model. And we as consumers even need to go to Toyota and say, hey, that Prius is great, but let's have a plug-in version. We want to get off of oil. Help us do it. So if nothing else, I hope our movie, Who Killed the Electric Car, stirs some of this up.
And we have on the line William in Belvedere. Good morning, William.
Yes, thank you very much. This is obviously a multifaceted situation, and I hope that the issue that I'm going to be addressing won't seem to be too narrow. However, this concept of using what's called agricultural waste, such things to produce fuel, such things as were mentioned were rice straw, switchgrass, tree prunings, and maybe one could even say corn stalks, but certainly the first three. There is an assumption that this is waste, but it is not waste. It's only waste because of it being burned, etc. When you take things out of the soil come to be, therefore, in rice straw, switchgrass, tree prunings, etc., those things have to be replaced. Now, it is true under the current arrangement, because you have to grow things one crop after another, these things are just burned. However, if they are plowed back into the soil, then they will replace the nutrients. You do not replace the nutrients in the soil that are contained in what we call waste, then you have to get into the whole fertilizer industry. And that, as we well know, has all kinds of implications itself. So I think we are identifying too many things as waste that could be made into fuel. We are identifying things that really should not be seen as waste. And I would appreciate the comments of the guests.
Thank you, William.
Yeah, excellent point. I think it's a very, very excellent point. But there's no doubt that we can make more use of these agricultural resources and help protect the soil. Help use some of these crops and waste products to develop liquid fuels. You can do both, but you have to manage it correctly. For example, switchgrass is something which is talked about quite a bit. It's a prairie grass. It's actually not so well suited for California. You need more rainfall than we get, but in other parts of the country. So let's talk about switchgrass for a second. Switchgrass actually can be grown on more marginal lands. It's not an annual crop, so you don't have to rip it up and till the soil. So you get better soil conservation and soil erosion in that way. You don't have to use all the fertilizers and pesticides as you use currently on the main agricultural crops. It can be very, in fact, they grow it on some of these agricultural lands that aren't in full production to help conserve the soil. So you can envision a system, but I think the listener is exactly right. You have to have a good system in place to make sure you don't have adverse consequences. We do know that there are problems with how corn, for example, is grown in this country. But the key point here is it better for the environment? That's the question we have to ask ourselves. Is it better for the environment than turning coal into a liquid fuel or ripping up the parts of Canada for tar sands or converting oil shale in Wyoming into gasoline for your tank?
And our experience on this film and talking to the scientists we did is really that electricity, it's renewable electricity, especially from wind, which is the cheapest. And you put it in the Midwest, it's as low as 6 cents a kilowatt hour. This stuff is completely clean. It doesn't compete with food and other agricultural issues. And it needs a commitment by the public, by the government to, like, let's clean up our grid and certainly power a much, much larger percentage of our vehicles with electricity.
I got a question here that's addressed to Roland Huang from Richard in Oakland, and the question, it's a statement into a question. I understand that petroleum-based diesel is extremely dirty and toxic, this despite the urgings of the petroleum and auto industries. How does biodiesel fare in comparison, specifically regarding NO2 particulates and CO2?
Great question. diesel in its current form right now is one of the most toxic forms of fossil fuels. It creates a lot of particulates. It's actually a cancer-causing agent, and there's a lot of work here in California right now to clean up diesel equipment, diesel trucks, ports are a big source of diesel pollution. Biodiesel can be helpful in that respect. CO2, you get significant major, probably the order of 70 or 80% reductions in global warming pollution. Particles are reduced, most definitely. The one problem with biodiesel, if you use it in high concentration, say, be 20% or greater, you probably will get some increases in nitrogen oxides, which is a pollutant, which is a precursor to smog. It's also a precursor to small particles. So you don't want that to happen. But there are additives which you can put into the biodiesel, which will ensure that that problem doesn't occur. So again, technology, you can't think of a technology which doesn't have some downsides. And I think your listeners are identifying it. But the question is, can we control the downsides, and are they better than petroleum?
There is another email from a listener who wanted to remind us that there is a biodiesel fuel station in Berkeley, and that's called the Biofuel Oasis at 2465 4th Street at Dwight Way. And Chris Payne, you wanted to weigh in here?
Oh, no, I'm enjoying this conversation. Yeah.
He's applauding. We have another caller on the line, Elvis in Oakland.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Are you lonesome tonight? Listen.
Thank you.
This has to be discussed a little bit. Well, let me make two real quick points. Both of these have to be made. The first one is that the California Air Resources Board is not, never was, an elected body and not a legislative body. Therefore, any edict it issues, like this one it issued several years back, this is by year such and such, 10% of the cars in California must be electric powered, they have no right to issue such an edict. Okay, so it deserves to be ignored.
Can we address that first point?
Yeah, please.
I mean, this is really a question about what kind of society we live in.
May I make my second point first?
Oh, sure.
Quickly, actually, because we are running out of time in this segment.
The second point is this. 52% of all the electricity in this country comes from burning coal. You're doing absolutely nothing by taking the emissions from the tailpipes of the cars and putting it in the emissions of a smokestack up in the Four Corners area of northern Arizona, polluting the Indian reservations up there.
I think that's a good point that we actually were discussing before, and I'm sorry to interrupt you. It's just that we need to move on to another segment really quickly here, and I wanted to give a chance to kind of address your comments, both of which are appreciated, and then move on through the end of this segment. Thanks, Elvis.
Yeah, well, I mean, just briefly, we did discuss the CO2, and there is a net reduction even with coal, so electricity is a better way to do it. And so the first point is, this is exactly what government's for. You know, corporations, their job, their legislative job is to, or not legislative, but their job is to make money. Government is to protect people, and nobody is, like, you know, going to protect us from air pollution and long-term problems that people making money are. So this is a terrific reason for government to step in and say, hey, we need alternative energies. Corporations have to have a level playing field and get us some options. And I think the real crime at the center of who killed the electric car is, why are there no plug-in vehicles on the road? And this is a great place for government. So I would disagree with your caller on that.
And, you know, we need to wrap up this segment. We have some of the KTFA apprenticeship program members coming in to talk about how folks can get involved in that. Wanted to mention again that the Natural Resources Defense Council and Roland Wong and others are working on a ballot initiative that's going to be up for the vote in November, and wanted just to ask Roland to mention that one more time.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. And I wanted to mention that, again, it's the Clean Alternative Energy Act. It will be on the November ballot. The website is www.yesonCleanEnergy.com, and anything folks could do to help support it would be really terrific, because we're up against some very deep pockets. We don't have $50 million in the public interest to fight what will be a very vigorous anti-initiative campaign run by the oil companies.
Thanks very much for being with us today, Roland Wong.
Thank you.
And Chris Payne, your film, Who Killed the Electric Car, has opened in the Bay Area, opened on Friday. How long's the run? Well, I guess it depends on how many people go to see it.
That's right. Everything depends on these 2 weeks right now. So if you have any interest in seeing this movie, now's the time to go. And if you do get to see it and you like it, please tell your friends. The documentary is Live and Breathe, based on people going to the box office in the first week or two.
Is there a website?
Yeah, whokilledtheelectriccar.com. It's actually a terrific site. It's not just a marketing site. There's a lot of information about hybrids and all kinds of cars, and as well as theater times.
Somebody did just send an email about something, two people did actually, about something we didn't discuss, and that was recycling the batteries that go into electric cars, and I know we had wanted to mention that. So.
Oh, sure, yeah, this is a great concern. Well, the quick answer is that lead-acid batteries have been in regular gas cars for years, and there's a very established recycling business for it. You take your Sears, they give you your battery back, and so forth, and very few actually end up in landfills. In fact, the number one battery pollution is from disposables, from flashlights, from all these kinds of things. And the good news on batteries is that nickel batteries and lithium batteries are even more valuable because of the commodity cost of lithium and nickel. So these batteries are very likely not to end up in recycled situations.
And the materials are much less toxic than lead. It's lithium ion and nickel metal hydride. Lead is a very toxic material. You don't want to get in there. And, of course, as Chris is saying, you're not going to dump a 200-pound battery pack into the garbage can like you do with some of your current small D-cell or C-cell type batteries.
Okay, Roland Wong and Chris Payne, thank you so much for joining us today on Sunday Salon.